Welcome back to Birds of a Feather Talk Together. This week we are talking all about bald eagles. Growing up, I remember how rare and exciting it was to see a bald eagle. I'd seen maybe one or two in my entire childhood, but today I see them quite often. We learned from John and Shannon about how their populations were affected by DDT, and how it's taken time for them to come back. It often takes generations to recover from something like that. And since they're long-lived, we are really just seeing the result of this in certain parts of the U.S. now. They're so bold and striking when you see them, and Shannon will be quick to tell you that they aren't just an American bird, but a North American bird. John, Shannon, Amanda, and myself have a blast talking all about bald eagles. Okay, go grab your binoculars, and let's get into it. All right, so welcome back, everyone. This is RJ, and I'm with John, Shannon, and Amanda. It's the core four of us today, and we're talking about the bald eagle. We had somebody write in and request to do a bald eagle episode. It was a photographer in the Chicago area, Dustin Widener, who asked for us to do a bald eagle episode. So yeah, we're going to talk about the bald eagle today. And I don't know, I feel like as Americans, you're kind of like taught that bald eagles are just this like amazing bird, and you know, not that they're not, but it's really kind of pushed on us. And so Shannon, to kick it off, I was kind of curious, as a Canadian without the American bias, how you feel about bald eagles in general.
There are more bald eagles in Canada than there are in the United States. They didn't decline as precipitously in Canada as they did in the United States. So if they were going to be going from one place and repopulating another place, there were going to be Canadian bald eagles that were going to be doing that. Yeah, the idea that any country can claim primacy over something that is not confined to its borders is crazy. And first off, anyways, I know it is an American symbol, but I feel like that taints the bird. Its greatness is not confined to the United States of America. No matter if I am now, you know, a dual citizen, it's one of those things that ticks off Canadians.
Oh, really?
Actually, that's an interesting point, right? Ben Franklin pushed really hard to have it be the wild turkey.
No, apparently he didn't. Yeah. I tried to look that up today. He didn't push that hard for it to be the turkey. But he didn't eagles.
He just said the eagles were not particularly worthy of being the emblem, I guess. All right.
Yeah, he said they hilarious.
He said they had bad moral character, bald eagles.
I was wondering, it just shows you that the implication there is that Franklin was a little bit of a bird watcher.
Yes.
That
he wrote that in a letter to his daughter, his pronouncements on the bald eagle. And it's really hilarious. He says they don't make a living honestly, and no big bird worth its salt could be driven away by a little tiny songbird.
Oh.
So it was really funny to think of getting that kind of a letter from your very famous father.
But I also think that in thinking about bald eagle as the choice, and given when it was made, which was back in that time, they didn't know much about the rest of North America then. And one of the interesting things about bald eagle is it is a really good choice in the sense that, with all due respect to the Canadians, it's a North American bird.
The north part. quit owning the American part, because you don't.
Well, I'm surprised that they wouldn't have picked something that was more confined, you know, just to the East Coast, because they didn't know any better. And one of the neat things about bald eagle, and again, it's one of these birds that whose population increases as the result of the banning of DDT have been dramatic, such that it's become much more common across all of the lower 48 states, basically.
You know, there used to be a bounty on them historically, and you could, it's like 50 cents a bird, I think, is what you could make, because they were so common that the salmon stocks were in jeopardy. So in Alaska, they had a bounty on them. You could make money by killing them, and thereby supposedly saving salmon stocks. but it didn't take very long for, you know, for their numbers to plummet and for them to be on regional and then countrywide endangered species lists. But they were not on endangered species lists in Canada, which is something I find interesting too.
Yeah. And that's in part because there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't anywhere near as much DDT used on the farmland, in, which is mostly within, 100 kilometers of the U.S. border in Canada.
Yeah. So all that's kind of hard to grow crops where permafrost is. Yeah.
But I, you know, and Franklin was right. I mean, they're one of the reasons why they're so successful is they definitely are, from a bird of prey perspective, although they catch live fish, they're willing to eat carrion. You know, their diet is pretty broad.
And so they'll steal things from other birds. And we know, how often are they just getting their food, like not from hunting?
Depends on where they are and on the time of year. So if they can find places, for instance, one of the reasons why they like to be around dams is dams have a terrible habit of killing a lot of fish. And so below dams, there are often periods of time where there are pieces of fish coming out on a regular basis and they can eat there. They show up at dumps in up in Alaska because there's food that they can actually, you know, there's leftover meat and things like that they can actually find and eat.
So just eating garbage?
That's American.
I mean, I know I was just a bit mean to bald eagles, but they really are spectacular. And actually, the videos of them stealing fish from other bald eagles are rather astonishing. And so are videos of their own display behaviors rather astonishing.
Yeah.
As well.
Really... Are you talking about their aerial, cartwheel thing that they do?
Yeah, exactly.
We were watching videos of that.
We've been watching videos of that. Can you guys talk about that a little bit? Like, what it looks like and what's going on there?
It's a courtship display, and the pairs will basically lock their talons and then just spiral down till they're fairly close to the ground before they break apart. And I don't think anybody knows for sure what's going on in the minds of those two birds as they're doing that. I actually just saw a couple of red tails do that above Memorial Park Cemetery probably 3 weeks ago or so. So they're not the only species of bird of prey that does something like that. So that implies that it's something that's been around in the evolution of that group of birds of prey. But I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're willing to do that with your mate, then maybe... That means you're going to be a good provider when the chicks hatch. And that's the pair bonds in these birds are long frequently. You know, these are long lived birds. And that's one of the reasons why it took a long time for their populations to bounce back after they were decimated by having no reproductive success during the DDT era.
Yeah, they're not like bacteria. That have very short generation times, or even a songbird that has a short generation time or 2-3 years, something like that. These things are long lived and it takes a while for their populations to increase. So did you look at videos of that, the roller coaster behavior thing that they do where they go up in the air and they, it's like they're on a roller coaster. They go up and then they fly straight down almost to the ground before they kind of pull up and veer off.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I just think they do it because they can. But once you learn how to not kill yourself by doing that, you're going to try, right? And if it helps you get mates, well, you're going to get better at it. So you can look like a bird of paradise and dance like a mannequin and all of these things, or you can be on you're a roller coaster or make these elaborate aerial dances. You know, everything has their thing.
Wow.
I think we saw videos of them practicing. I saw that juvenile bald eagles will practice that cartwheel thing with other ones, to learn how to do it until they're ready to actually start courting, which was kind of funny, we thought.
Yeah. Well, it takes them like a really few cool years to, see to get adult plumage, right? So they're not ready to breed right away. It takes them 4.5, 5.5, I think, roughly, years to get that classic white head and be ready to breed. So, yeah, you practice. Lots of birds practice, you know, learning to sing if you're a songbird. That's part innate, that you have the vocal apparatus to do that. And then part learned. You're hanging around things of your own species. You learn how to sing the song. So you got to learn how to behave. Some behaviors are innate, others are learned.
Well, it's interesting. If you're a bald eagle, you've got to learn how to potentially steal things from other birds. You've got to, so there's hunt for yourself. I mean, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Going back to the mating thing, we read, or I guess it was in a video, we saw something like a bald eagle pair will be together for one breeding season before they actually mate. RJ, is that what we saw?
Yeah, that's what the video that we watched said. Have you heard that before, John and Shannon?
So I think one of the things that some of this illustrates is how hard it is to really get data on what's going on across an entire population of birds, given the kind of age structure we were just talking about. So if you think about it like humans, I mean, think about how many different ways couples come together. And my guess is that they're, if you get a young pair of bald eagles that come together, it may take them a year to figure out what they're doing. I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting is their nests are really big. And so if you're a young pair of bald eagles, you may not build a nest that's actually capable of really being the kind of structure that you need to actually feed young. And then there are these other places where you've got pairs that have been together for 12 or 13 years, and these nests are 12 feet high and 3 or 4 feet wide. And so I'll bet there's a lot of variation in that depending on the age of the individuals in the pair.
Oh, that makes sense.
And the experience. So one of the things, actually that's an interesting aspect of bald eagles. One of the drawbacks of studying bald eagles is they haven't really come up with good ways to mark them as individuals. So it's very hard to tell males from females, and it's not easy to kind of put color bands on them like you would with some smaller birds. And so I think there's not a lot of good information about how these pairs are actually interacting with one another as they come together and start forming a pair.
One of my funnest memories of moving to Illinois, when our son was pretty little, we went to Galena along the Mississippi, and seeing so many bald eagles there was, because I'm used to seeing bald eagles, but in my places. I had never been to a place in the U.S. really where there were that many bald eagles just, you know, hanging out by the water. And it was really, it was very majestic. Galena is really nice for anybody who comes to Illinois. There are bluffs and almost cliff-like things at Galena.
Yeah, Amanda and I go there like once a year, and we have seen bald eagles every time we've gone there, just either flying overhead, or there was like a rest stop. We stopped like 15 minutes outside of town and just looked in there as a pair of bald eagles on a tree.
Yeah.
Like it was, yeah, it's definitely bald eagle country when you get out there.
Yeah.
And certainly that's in the winter, there's large numbers that winter along the Mississippi there. And then a lot of those birds will breed probably all the way up in northern Canada. And so the migrations of the movements of bald eagles are really interesting too, because a lot of them are tied to going places where they can find open water and fish. And so that could mean migrating north in some areas in the western part of the U.S.
Wow.
I was just going to ask, there was a bald eagle in Chicago recently, right?
So that's an interesting thing. There are actually a couple nesting sites around the area. So I think they've nested at Skokie Lagoons, and yeah, there's some other sites on the south side. And there was one out in Boosie Woods that you used to be able to see from the interstate to I-90. And that tree fell over. And again, they like to build these big bulky nests. And I think eventually if the tree's dead, it's going to give way. And that's what finally happened there. So I don't know what they've done.
Wow. I was reading that sometimes they can take 3 months to actually build that nest. They're so big, and they'll use it year after year after year, add to it, which I also found pretty interesting. So, and you look at one of those nests that are absolutely enormous, and you can just think of how many years a bird might have been using that nest. It's really pretty amazing.
I like seeing the pictures of them actually carrying these things, you know, the branches that they'll put on these nests. I mean, because they are quite big.
Yeah.
I was looking up just because I was curious, the largest bald eagle nest, and it said that it was over 8 feet across and 18 feet tall, and I think weighed a couple tons or something like that.
Oh, that's crazy.
I mean,
holy cow. Yes.
It's like in a studio apartment almost, like 8 feet across, 18 feet tall.
I mean, there's no doubt that bald eagles are revered in many, many, many different places and cultures. So I looked up the names that there's just a whole page of names in different cultures and languages that have been used for bald eagles. And so that part of them that makes them more charming to me, maybe even, is that a lot of Native American tribes think of them as messengers between the gods and living humans. And, you know, whatever I believe, I like to think of that as a nice thing.
Yeah. And,
sure.
That's really cool. Yeah.
So a lot of artifacts have bald eagle parts, beaks, feathers, lots of feathers of bald eagles have found their way into to use and for varying cultural purposes.
And as a matter of fact, there's legislation that actually dictates that happens. If a bald eagle's found dead and there are feathers available, the first thing is for them to go to the Native American groups in the U.S.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
That's so interesting.
Yeah,
I think they are so striking when you see them. People are just drawn to them, whether it's, you know, American culture or not. I can see why Native Americans are drawn to them too. The size of them and just that white head and white tail. Like, I feel like even for people who aren't a birder, if you see a bald eagle, you stop and look at it. Whereas, you know, other big, you know, birds, you might just kind of go on your way. Like something about that white head and just the size of them. It's just pretty incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Really catches you. Yeah.
And again, they're fun to see up close.
How many do you have at the museum?
So we have 195 in the genus. So there's another species in that genus. And 108 are actual bald eagles. So we have 108 of those in our collections. But the one thing that I guess you really appreciate when you look up close is just how different the feet and the heads and the beaks are of all of these things that are called birds of prey. And they're all different, feet size different, beak sizes enormously different for birds that, you know, kind of do the same thing, right? And that's, again, the advantage of having the specimens there, to look at them up close and personal.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that some of those specimens, a lot of them are not a lot, but there's a good series of eggs. And those were collected back in the early 1900s. And some of those were collected in Virginia. And when we show people the collection, one of the things I like to emphasize is those eggs collected in 1910, 1920 were actually used in the 1960s by this set of researchers from Wisconsin, which we might have talked about before, who went around to egg collections and got data on birds like bald eagle and peregrine falcon and osprey that were being decimated by DDT, and measured eggshell thickness in the pre-DDT era and the post-DDT era to show that thinning was happening in areas where DDT was being used. And so that area in Virginia, those eggs would have been used as a pre-DDT era set of eggs to show that thinning was happening in Virginia in modern bald eagle eggs in the 1960s. And so, you know, again, whenever we talk to people about the egg collection like that, I like to point out that the guy that collected those in the early 1900s, had no idea that they'd be used for the to argue for the preservation of that species. And as Shannon said earlier, it's a, you know, it's a bird whose population numbers came back such that it's been taken off the endangered species list, which is certainly not something that that happens on a regular basis.
Right. That is awesome.
Yeah, I looked at I wanted to see kind of how they proved what DDT did. So it affects calcium transport, and I mean it affects a lot of other things too. But the calcium transport meant that there was just not enough calcium to make strong enough eggs. And there was a study that was published in 1977 where they fed mallard ducks a diet that was laced with DDT to the levels that you would see in the environment, and they could chart exactly how the DDT was affecting the reproductive parts of the mallard. So it was the mallard that actually showed people exactly what was happening molecularly inside of the bird, the bird eggs.
That's crazy.
So how long ago did, I mean, I'm not familiar with all of the, I know about DDT and everything, but how recent did all those rules go into effect? And now we're starting to see things coming back and the benefits of removing it. Can you talk a little bit about the timeline of that and everything?
Yeah. So the problems began to be realized. I mean, Rachel Carson wrote about it in Silent Spring so this was in the 60s, and I think the legislation and the banning began to happen in the very late 60s, early 70s is when that happened. And then it took all that time for bald eagle populations to come back. And again, that shouldn't be that surprising given the lifespan of these birds and their reproductive output is, you know, they're going to have slow population growth. But once that happened, bald eagles began to come back in across the eastern U.S., which is where they were most affected.
So they were removed from the Endangered Species Act in 2007. And I think the current estimates, something I read suggested it was over 300,000, like 320,000 or so bald eagles as the estimated population in the U.S., outside of Alaska, I suppose. But it took a while for them to be listed because the effects are not universal, right? So if you were in the Northwest, you weren't getting exposed to nearly as much DDT. So those populations were not endangered in the same way that the populations in the southern parts of the middle and southern parts of the U.S. were.
You know, and my recollection is growing up in Arizona, there were a couple pairs in the entire state that anybody knew about.
Wow.
And that's just because Arizona isn't a particularly great place to find fish and water courses. And so there have never been many bald eagles in Arizona.
And growing up, it wouldn't have dawned on me that they were endangered anywhere.
Yeah, there are so many.
I certainly don't remember seeing them growing up anywhere around here. Maybe I wasn't looking for them, but now it seems like we're definitely, you know, you mentioned the pair in the Skokie Lagoons. Amanda, do you want to talk about the ones in Libertyville?
Yeah, so I grew up in Libertyville, and two of my sisters live there now with their families. And one sister, or actually, they both kind of live near this Butler Lake, which is right by the high school. And they have a pair of eagles at this Butler Lake. And my one sister has a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
Oh, and now they're so cute.
They are so cute. And he's not super into the outdoors in the first place. But now when he goes out into their yard, he has to wear an eagle suit. Because they're very concerned about this pair of eagles because they're around all the time now. But it just cracks us up because Ashley sent us a picture of Hunter in this eagle suit and he was not happy about it. And I'm sure he like never goes outside now. So, but that's like amazing to me that they're that common, you know.
Yeah. And so that's designed so that the eagle can't carry him off. Is that right? Exactly, yes. Oh my gosh.
You're right. It's got all these hard shell. Yes.
Like a hard shell, like saddle almost that covers this whole
the poor
top.
Thing.
That,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's got like these plastic, like almost like, not like spikes, but these plastic things, you know, coming out, you know, I guess to make him look bigger or something. I don't know. But he is not into it.
My brother has a Papillon, and his name is Vinny, and he is the most expressive dog I have ever seen. But he also does, it's cold and wet in Vancouver where they live, and so Vinny has outdoor clothes as well. And he absolutely hates having the coat put on him. You should see the changes in his face are so expressive. And if he had any access to weapons, he would do you in a heartbeat. When you try to make him go outside, put his little coat on, go outside, he actually will, even though he weighs, I don't know, just a few pounds, he's really hard to move when he doesn't want to go places. So he just kind of digs himself in, and then he looks at you like you are absolutely torturing him, that you are the meanest, horriblest person that's ever existed on the face of the earth. And he wants to let you know the only way he can, which is with that stare.
Oh, poor Vinny. But, yeah, it's not fun putting on your winter clothes.
Well, it's not fun getting carried off by a bald eagle either. So
true. Like
they may not realize it, but man, I mean, they're, again, bald eagles are incredibly opportunistic. So I think of them, I've seen them on Christmas counts up in Madison, Wisconsin, where the big lakes have mostly iced up and there are these little open areas that are just have, you know, they might have 150 wintering coots on them. And the coots are just constantly being harassed by the wintering bald eagles in the area. And they're not going to fly because they can't get off the water that quickly. And so that's not a good way to escape. And so these eagles fly over and the coots are basically just in this giant group where they're trying to get underwater for long enough that their buddy is the one, if he doesn't get under, that gets nailed by the bald eagle as opposed to them. I mean,
gosh.
It's just, yeah. Okay.
So I looked up fun facts about bald eagles. And I mean, they can fly over 10,000 feet in the air. They can, so that's pretty high. But also, they have really good eyesight. And I guess I don't think I knew this. They have 340 degrees of vision, which is better than most owls do, too. And if you're going to be flying up in the air and trying to find either a dead thing that's not moving or some fish that's in the water, their visual systems are amazing. They see 8 times better than us. And their grip from their talons are at 400 PSI, which is, you know, 10 times the strength of the strongest person. So think about the force that they could grip those fish with. It's pretty amazing.
That's
insane.
Yeah,
you do not want to get, if you, not that you handle that many, any of us would handle that many bald eagles, but you do not want to get your hand inside that talon, because they'll just close up. And yeah,
well, I don't want to get my hand by the mouth of a cardinal, so
yeah, imagine an eagle.
But you know, in with respect to the eyesight, I think the other thing that they must have is really good ability to look at the landscape. And I say this because one of the things they've done with bald eagles is they've put a lot of radio transmitters on them, or satellite transmitters. And so they're big enough that they can actually put these responders I can never get my terminology right, trackers that allow them to use satellite tracking. So they can get real-time data over time. And when they've done this, they do all kinds of interesting things. So I remember one individual that was, I think, brought into a rehab center in North Carolina, and they put a tracker on it when they finally released this young bird, and it hung around the immediate area for a while. And then one day it just took off and it flew 300 miles to the west, spent some time over there, and then came straight back to the other area. And then later on it moved north, presumably with potentially other bald eagles, potentially to find a mate or something. But my point is that in order to do that, you must be able to have a really good idea of the spatial landscape and being able to memorize what you've looked at in terms of markers for yourself. And having that good eyesight would allow you to do that, I think.
Yeah. Wow. That is cool.
And they're not leaving popcorn trails. Find their way back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have to remember. Wow. Man.
I think we're getting kind of close on time. Is there anything else on bald eagles we want to touch on?
I think Ben Franklin was wrong.
Oh. Right on, John. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're citizens of the world, not citizens of the United States of America. That's my parting words.
Hey, after our Florida trip, I was thinking a pelican could be a good American. I mean, I guess they're a lot more than just the U.S., but we can claim
indeed.
Something else.
No, you can't claim other things. There's not very
that's
many.
It's the American way. She...
How many brown pelicans up in Canada?
We're taking them then. We're taking them. Yes.
Well, you do usually take what you want anyway.
Right. Well, we do have a mailbag question this week. So this is from Ariana in Logan Square, Chicago. And she said, I hope you're all having a happy start to spring migration. I saw two golden crowned kinglets, a hermit thrush, and an eastern towhee in my yard this morning, and it made my whole damn day.
That's awesome.
I can't remember what episode it was, but either John or Shannon mentioned birding at Cape Flattery in Washington. And I'm actually going out west in June and would love to know if there's any specific birds they suggest I keep an eye out for.
The best puffin? The tufted one?
Yes. Well, what I think she should do is get on eBird and look at what's been seen and where to go in the areas where she's going. And, you know, the neat thing about the West Coast and that part of the world is it's dramatically different which side of the Rockies you're on. So on the west side, it's much wetter than it is on the east side. And so if you start in Seattle and you drive westward, you cross over the Rockies and suddenly you get down into a much drier area that's a lot like the places that you guys were in Colorado, as opposed to what's on the west side, which is it's actually rainforest on the Olympic Peninsula. And so the birds are different in those two areas. And that's, again, one of the things that makes it so much fun.
I don't know.
And if she really, you know, like we were talking about, maybe she could do both. You like get a car and do a little driving if you can talk the people with you into doing it.
Yeah. For varied thrushes, depending on where you go. Thinking of things that are really pretty different from what you might see in Logan Square. And then even though this is not a bird, if you are on the coast and you look out, you might be able to see a sea otter in the water. And sea otters are some of the most adorable animals ever, even if they do have fur and not feathers. But yeah, there's things you can see everywhere.
I mean, one of the things I remember is another relative of tufted puffin, which is pigeon guillemot. Which is another coastal bird,
cool,
and they're
too
beautiful. What else? I went to the University of Washington my freshman year, which is in Seattle, and left because it rained too much. But one of the things I remembered was there were an awful lot of ducks around, and I think I had something like 8 species of ducks over the time I was there, just on this big fountain on the UW campus.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And awesome. Then go have some fresh salmon and some smoked salmon, because it tastes there. It doesn't taste the same anywhere else. So you can get it in sushi places and stuff around here, but it is not the same as getting Pacific Northwest salmon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for your question, Ariana.
And she should take us with her.
All right.
Yes.
And take some pictures while you're there, too.
Yes.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. make sure to check out our Instagram or TikTok for pictures of the birds that we discuss. If you have a question, please reach out to podcast.birdsofafeather@gmail.com. All right, see you all next week. Love you all. Thanks, everyone.